from the cosmic legends of the universe, Dave Damaschek. The mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
Hi and hello, podcasters. It's your old pal Dave, Dave Damaschek. What's going down? Hope all's well wherever you are. Here in Studio 66 in downtown Los Angeles, from 4,000 miles, 5,000 miles away. What is it from L.A. to New York City? I'm not exactly sure. I know it takes me all day to fly from one end of the country to the other. Looking forward now to Game 6 of the World Series, and actually, hopefully a Game 7 then, and to make for a truly classic fall classic. I hadn't realized until they mentioned it during the Game 5 broadcast that the series hasn't gone beyond five games since, 2003, I guess, when the Marlins and Yankees hooked up in Yankee Stadium when the Yankees last lost it there. So anyway, the point is, really looking forward to this. I imagine Phillies and Yankees fans both now biting their fingernails until Game 6 gets underway. I want to break it down from every conceivable angle here, and who better to do that with than with our old pal, baseball scribe, one of the more knowledgeable baseball guys you'll ever come across, the great Jonah Carey.
Jonah Carey is on the phone. Jonah Carey is on the phone. Hold on, we're listening to your intro. Jonah Carey is on the phone.
Here he is, everybody. A fan favorite, the ubiquitous Jonah Carey. What's going down, man? How are you?
Mr. Damaschek, I'm looking forward to this podcast. I have to say, you mentioned that after this you're running over to the Kimmel Show and you've got some stuff going on. Listen, you just tell them that Jonah Carey is on the phone and that'll take care of
everything. Well,
I didn't even intend to do that, but it was as if on cue it played for you. There you go.
Right.
It tagged your little wisecrack there. Yes, Kimmel, the star of Kenny Mayne's latest webisode there of Main Street there. Last week, the sports guy Simmons, now Kimmel, and who knows, next week maybe Jonah Carey. So, Jonah, we've been following you on WSJ.com. You've been live blogging through the World Series, but Game 6 now, you're not going to be doing it, eh? Why so?
I am not. I have a really good excuse. It's Flapjack's Briss.
Thank you for using the proper name.
Yes, and Pancake's baby naming. So it's a big deal in Judaism. We're doing them both on the same night. And, you know, you got to serve your cold cuts or whatever it is that people do. And, yeah, so I think I'll be able to watch most of the game. I just won't be in a working capacity. That's all.
Well, mazel tov to you and, you know, Pancake and Flapjack. And, we didn't have a Briss and, you know, I didn't have a formal thing. I was not on hand for this. But people say that it seems almost like a hokey joke at this point to make, like, oh, as the father, you can't watch that happen to your son. But people say, no, it is, in fact, unpleasant to watch. So be forewarned.
Unpleasant to watch. One of my best friends had, he had a boy, they're about 3 months old now, and I went to his Briss. I could not watch, and the only people that watched were him and my wife. Nobody else was able to do it. His wife was not able to do it. His family couldn't do it. Nobody could do it. He was interested in it, and my wife is just the opposite of squeamish. So she's like, oh, yeah, it was very medically interesting. I said, all right, whatever you say.
Well, we'll see how she enjoys watching her own spawn get the scissors or get the blade or whatever it is. But enough about that. Although you did say cold cuts, will there be some nice smoked whitefish and other assorted? That's the best thing are the smoked fishes.
The accoutrement. There'll be some sort of smoked salmon. That's a very, very standby thing to do. And you got to get the Jewish pastries and all that stuff. It's, the food is the best part. You deal with the pain of the boy for a few seconds, and then you're on to stuffing your face.
It really is. That is with Judaism, it's the start of life and the end of life. Smoked fish. You know, you go sit shiva at somebody's house. They always have a nice food spread there too. But all right, enough of that maudlin talk. And instead, let's talk about what you're going to be missing. And by the way, well, kudos to you. Great father, right? You know, just out of the gate as a father with the twins there. Missing Game 6, your favorite sport of baseball, and you're going to, I assume, have to come back and watch it on TiVo, right?
Well, I mean, the Briss is at 7 and the game is at 8. So the procedure will certainly be over. It's more a matter of not being terribly rude to guests. So the key is, can I hornswoggle the guests upstairs to where the TV is and make that happen? And my prediction is, yes, I will be able to. Just because I'm not working doesn't mean I won't be able to watch. You know, maybe I'll TiVo the game, but I have a feeling that if I don't watch it live, I'll watch it quasi-live. So I have faith in my own ability.
All right, well, good for you. Yeah, Broca, Tato, and I. Come on, let's go, Moyle. Chop, chop. We get it, man. Yeah, no, listen, 2 weeks ago, I skipped out on watching the Steelers host the undefeated Vikings in favor of going to little baby Oprah. She and I went to a Halloween fair, so I have to pat myself on the back for that.
Wow.
One.
I mean, we're grown's up and we're grown's up and we're grown's up. I don't know what to tell you.
Well, thank goodness for TiVo. That's what I say.
Exactly.
I don't know if I would be in the running for Father of the Year if it weren't for my pal TiVo. But all right, let's talk about the World Series. And obviously, pretty compelling stuff so far. And it strikes me, I mean, that these fan bases are both so intense. You know, game four, you could feel that it wasn't just, you know, there are a lot of fan bases, and I think it's mostly people, you know, it's cities that get a team and 2 or 3 or 6 years later are suddenly playing for a championship. There's no downside for them. You know what I mean? They're enjoying the moment. This is exciting. We're on the big stage. We might win a ring. We might win the title. But the loss isn't going to be that painful for them. But you can feel with the Yankees fans and with the Phillies fans, it'll be devastating if they lose that. In game four, down that run, you figured that you could just feel the pins and needles. There wasn't much noise being made there because they knew, Mariano Rivera was an out away from getting out there in the ninth. Jabba Chamberlain was blowing the guys away. And then all of a sudden, Pedro Feliz hits that home run. And it was it was euphoria, but there was a great sense of relief. Like, oh, we're still in this thing. We might get it done yet. And then, you know, what happens the next half inning, ruins all that. But so with all that said, the question is, which fan base do you feel like deserves it more?
I mean, the Phillies won last year and the Yankees haven't won this decade. So I guess you could argue that
right.
The Yankees. It's very strange to say that the Yankees fan base deserves anything more than any other team. But I guess you could make that argument. And I think that defrays a little bit of the pain of the loss, too. I mean, you know, not that the Phillies fans would not be pained if they did lose this one. But, hey, they're coming off a World Series. I mean, that was their first one in 28 years. And they have a long and sordid history of losing, but, you know, in the early part of the century, of the 20th century, this was maybe, you know, this was like the Clippers of baseball. This was the worst franchise that just lost all the time. It wasn't until the Whiz Kids in 1950 that they did anything. Then you had another long drought. Then you have the Carlton years, then the 1980. Then you go another 28 years, and you've got Mitch Williams in between. So lots and lots of suffering. So it all depends. I mean, is the recency in effect here where you're talking about, oh, well, you know, this team won last year, so don't worry about it? Or do you have to go back 100 years and say, well, listen, the Phillies have had a miserable franchise history, and the Yankees have Ruth and Gehrig and DiMaggio and Clay Bellinger, and therefore they deserve it more?
Yeah, it's tough, you know, because there's an expectation that comes along with being a Yankees fan. I don't really, if you're 24 and you decide to embrace the New York Yankees, then shame on you. But if you're born into it, then I hold no grudge against you for sticking with your team. You were just born into the right situation, so be it. But I also, there's part of me that I don't think resent is the right word, but yeah, you know, when they're fist pumping because Mariano Rivera records another out, or actually even worse, CC Sabathia is dominating and they're fist pumping and they're psyched. It's like, listen, he's a mercenary. What do you want? This is not your organization being savvy. You just outspent everybody to get the best huge lefty out on the market, and he's doing what he's supposed to do. That's sort of the, it would be great to be a Yankees fan, but that's sort of the shame, because your expectation, the analogy I always use is that it's like having a straight A student. You know, if that kid ever comes home with a B+, as the parent, you'd be outraged. You know, whereas if you're a Royals or Pirates fan, if your boy ties your shoe, it's cause for celebration. Yeah, there's a different standard there. I feel bad for Yankees fans when they don't get it done for this long a stretch. You know what I'm saying?
Well, that's right. And you talked about pain, and to me it's a pain versus methodology kind of thing here. It is unacceptable for the Yankees to lose every single year they're trying to win. Every year, since the mid-90s, since the strike year, really, they've been trying to win. You can argue before that, too, but they've made a concerted effort, and they've either won or they've come close to winning every single year since then. And, I mean, that's great, and it's wonderful to have a fan base that can rely on that. But at the same time, yeah, expectations are sky high. And how many teams have that luxury? Forget about just baseball in any sport. I mean, it's very rare. Really, in baseball, you're talking, you know, Yankees and Red Sox, you can make that case. Phillies are kind of nouveau riche at this point. We're going to have to wait and see if they're really going to, you know, go for that blueprint, or if a couple of years from now, when Ryan Howard's getting older or whatever, they're going to have to rebuild. I don't know. But certainly with the Yankees, they're going to keep doing it over and over and over. Now, they're living on borrowed time a little bit. It's amazing how good they were this year. I mean, Teixeira and Sabathia and all these guys are good. But listen, I mean, did we really expect Damon and Matsui and Pettit and Posada and Rivera and all these guys? They're old. They're all old. They're 35, they're 38, they're 40, and they all had big, big seasons to go with some of the younger guys. And when I say younger, I still mean, what, 30, 32, 35. So, yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing where they're going to try to win again next year, but we could see a different cast. I don't know if Matsui's going to be back. Some of the other guys, I think they might try to shift it around. They're going to have to make that team younger, but still try to compete. So there is that. I mean, the pressure is certainly there.
Yeah, so I guess there really isn't a correct answer to this. I was just musing over it and thinking, you know, from a Philadelphia sports fan's perspective. And by the way, what a day Sunday could have been for them to watch them destroy the Giants, then tailgate for a couple hours, and then head into Citizens to watch them win game four.
And then come back and win in dramatic fashion. That would have been unbelievable.
Yeah, just about get that one done. And, you know, if they get it done, if they can come back and win this World Series, all demons shall be exercised for them, I feel like, as Philadelphia fans.
Well, except for
fans.
The Eagles demons, which may remain in place forever. And that's the thing about this city is that, you know, you look at New York, okay, so they've got the Giants. You know, I mean, you can make that case that even if the Yankees falter, they've still got a team that has recent success. The Eagles are just, you know, the snake bit. I mean, over and over, it's the same thing. I mean, it happens all the time. I don't know if the Knicks, if the negative karma of the Knicks is enough to counteract the Giants, and then you're back to going back to baseball. I mean, we could philosophize about this a lot. I mean, it sort of depends. But, yeah, there is definite pain with the Eagles, and I don't know. I mean, it's the same. It's Andy Reid and McNabb. How long have they been there? It seems like they've been there since the 70s.
It really is amazing how long their run's been and how unorthodox Andy Reid's approach is and how it's been relatively successful until they get deep into the postseason. But, you know, I don't remember if I was talking to you or who it was on the podcast, but we're talking Philadelphia and talk about snake bitten. You talk about the Philadelphia Flyers. That is one of those iconically cursed positions. The Philadelphia Flyers have never been able to address since Bernie Parent, have never been able to get Ron Hextall, had some years there, but they never had the thing that always fails them come playoff time is the lack of goalie. And I was a solid netminder. And I was thinking about it in all of sports, is there what positions are there on one team that that perennially never get resolved? You know what I'm saying? The Flyers can never find a goalie.
The Red Sox shortstop, Nomar, and I mean, that's not that long, but it's been, you know, just a trail of tears. You're talking about Alex Cora and Jed Lowry and Alex Gonzalez and then Alex Gonzalez again and Nick Green and stuff like that. That comes to mind immediately. Let me think about what else.
And then, you know, you say the Red Sox, that reminds me, I think that Jacoby Ellsbury's finally done away with the idea that the Red Sox never have anybody who can steal bases for him. That's another
true.
One of those.
Yeah, that goes back a ways, too. I mean, in the Rice and Evans and Boggs era, I mean, that was the case, too. They had a very good offensive team, but they did not run.
Bears really struggled to have a good quarterback in
right.
the last
in fact,
40
that was
years.
Exactly what I was going to say. Well, Cordell was their quarterback at one point, so that's something you need to know. Yeah, you know, you could definitely make the case of quarterback. And obviously, certain positions, the onus becomes higher. I mean, if you're talking about, you know, a team doesn't have a closer and they keep blowing games in heartbreaking fashion in the ninth inning, that's a big problem. If you don't have a quarterback, that's a big problem. If you don't have a goalie, that's a big problem. And these are higher profile kind of things. I'm trying to think which team has just a miserable closer year after year. And that
yeah, there's got to be someone like that. Then the Pittsburgh Pirates don't have any major league level quality talent that's over the age of 26 and under contract for very
that's
long.
Right. Yeah, the Pirates, I guess you could say that it's the curse of every position on the whole roster.
Yeah, so, there's got to be, I'm sure there's an NBA team that we're not thinking of that never seems to have a decent center or a decent point, something like that. Anyway, let's move on from that. It's a fun thing to muse over. And we talk about snake bitten and all of that. It's funny to me that Melky Cabrera is out for the rest of the World Series. And by the way, doesn't he look like this, like Cleopatra? What is he doing with the eyebrows, Melky? Have you gotten a look at those?
I haven't really taken a close-up.
Get a good look. There are plenty of close-ups of him sitting in the dugout there. It's freaky, but Joe Girardi is talking during Game 5 to the broadcast booth. A very strange thing, this requirement that Major League Baseball... Yeah, during the game, you have to do interviews. It seems like a loco thing, but Joe Girardi's lamenting, yeah, we don't have Melky. That really hurts our lineup. Listen, what world are you living in when your number nine hitter is Melky Cabrera and is like, woe is us, what are we going to do now? So that makes me, that's one thing that
well,
that's
I, have
just,
to, I have to jump in on that for one second. It was woe is him in terms of the last game, but there's a very simple, two reasons for that. Number one, you're in the National League Park, so obviously your number nine hitter is not going to be effective either because it's the pitcher. Mm-hmm. So your number eight hitter is Melky, or your number seven hitter is Melky. The big problem, of course, is that Joe Girardi decides to shoot himself in the foot, and I will rant about this until the day I die, with Jose freaking Molina, who's terrible, versus Jorge Posada, who every time he comes up to bat, he seems to get a hit. Now, Jorge Posada has been, I don't know, at the mound, what, 712 times in this series?
I'm it's really annoying, yeah.
Record. It's annoying, but, I mean, the guy can hit. He's a great hitter. You know, I've maintained that he should be in the Hall of Fame. I think he's just that good a hitter, and he's vastly underrated. And, you know, so you're benching a guy who's still performing at that kind of level offensively for Molina. What kind of defensive mojo does he have that happens? You know, when Chase Utley hit the three-run home run, Burnett threw an absolute meatball. Did Molina call for that? Did he say, yeah, throw a fat pitch right over the middle of the plate? That's veteran leadership right there. You know, the whole point is they're saying, well, Burnett throws better when Molina's behind the plate. Burnett was horrible last night, and Molina doesn't hit. Don't give me Molina. I don't want to see Molina. There's no Molina. He is useless. He should not be on that team. He should not be in the major leagues.
Well, you know, you hear the back and forth of, well, it's not A.J. Burnett making the decision, and yet you see Molina behind the dish every time he's out there. So you do the math on that one. Now, on the other side of things, this thing about, you know, we talk about the intensity of the fans and on both sides of things, and, you know, obviously Philly has a reputation that, you know, maybe is a little outdated for being too harsh on its own players. But, man, oh, man, what is Cole Hamels thinking about when you play in Philadelphia? What is he doing saying what he said about, I'm ready for the season to end? Do you feel like that was out of context somehow, or was that just foolishness on his part?
I think the media trolls for stuff. I think after the game, you know, it's not enough for them. This guy went 2-for-4, and this guy pitched 6 innings and gave up 2 or 3 runs. They want something else. They, you know, this whole idea of you're gauging someone's character and you want to see what they're like and are they quitters, are they clutch and all this. And it's all a big soap opera. It's very strange sports. You know, in a way, it's a chick thing, really. I mean, it's just, oh, tell me about the personalities and, oh, let's get warm and fuzzy with Derek Jeter and, oh, Alex Rodriguez. Oh, he's a scoundrel. Oh, my gosh. And did you see this? And, oh, my God, he has a picture of himself as a centaur over his bed. Which, by the way, actually, that's awesome. So don't forget that. Forget I said that. I love that. But, I mean, you know, it's just, it's very strange, and I really do think that that's the case. I don't think that's the case with all media. I know plenty of good beat writers and plenty of good columnists. I've been shoulder to shoulder with them in clubhouses, and they do a really good job. But I do think that if you get into a scrum or you get into a situation where you have 50 or 100 writers and it's the World Series, somebody's going to ask something like that. And, you know, honestly, the players just have to, you almost have to go into robot mode. People fault Alex Rodriguez, or at least the media does, that he doesn't give good quotes, that he's very boring. You have to be boring because they're going to spin something a certain way. I'm sure that the words that Hamill said are not incorrect. They didn't change the quote because you could actually get in trouble for that as a journalist. But, you know, did he really mean, oh, my God, I don't want to be on this team. I hate the Phillies. I hate the World Series. No, he's just saying that he's thrown 250 innings this season. And, you know, I'm sure he's achy and all this stuff. And he probably was just bummed after that particular game. So, yeah, this is the media trumping it up. And, you know, a little bit of Hamels. I mean, he's not necessarily, you know, a grit and nails kind of guy. But obviously this didn't need to happen if the media didn't want it to happen.
Yeah, SoCal guy. But, you know, 1 year removed, he's the hero of them finally winning the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
And with that in mind, if I'm Chaz Manuel and you get to a game seven, I'm running Hamels out there over the rookie Hap. How about you?
Yeah, I would too. You know, there's some interesting, and we've talked about this as well. I've maintained that Cliff Lee should have started game four. I felt that, you know, he would have been in position to start game seven. Clearly, he's their best pitcher. I don't think anybody in the universe would argue that. You know, there's a case to be made that he should have done that, and the Phillies could have still gone with four starters. They could have still used Blanton in game five, so Pedro doesn't have to go on short rest on game six. I think that would have been fine. So that really confused me why they didn't do that. I don't understand what Manuel thinks in terms of, oh, Lee is going to be so much less effective on short rest. I don't get that at all. And further, I'll go another one, and this was an interesting thought exercise that was brought up on the web. I want to say that it was on the something called the book blog. I think it's insidethebook.com, I'm pretty sure. I'm trying to plug as best as I can for the person who wrote that. But basically, the argument was the Phillies went up 6-1 in the third inning. What if you pulled Cliff Lee right then? Up 5 runs with 6 innings to go, there's a pretty darn good chance they're going to win even against the Yankees. They've got a good enough bullpen that it would have been fine. If they did that, Lee could have easily started game seven. Even if he pitched 4 innings or maybe into the 50, you know, I think he could have come back on, what is that, 2 days rest? 3 days rest?
Yeah, what would that be? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, you're right. But yeah, and in fact, Manuel even addressed that before the game. And by the way, I thought it was strange too that Manuel announced that game four starter was going to be Blanton before game three. I think that he should have left that open-ended and decided it based on the position they were in. I'm with you 100% on that.
And Lee threw some pitches in the first game that he probably didn't need to. Yes, he was throwing a historic game, and it was all pretty and stuff like that, but he could have thrown the seven innings and gone out of there and come back for 4-7. I mean, Sabathia's been a big asset to the Yankees going on short rest. So I really think that they could have done that, and I think they could have gotten gutsy with it yesterday if they really, really wanted to do something unorthodox. Of course, the problem is if Cliff Lee gets pulled in that game and they blow that lead, then Charlie Manuel not only will not manage for the Phillies, he will not manage any Little League team for the rest of his life. He would have been second-guessed unbelievably so, because unorthodox moves in baseball and in all of sports, and you know I love him, Dave, but nobody seems to like him within the sport. Everybody gets criticized, everybody gets fired, everybody gets second-guessed, and that kind of drives me crazy. I wish we would see kind of gutsy moves, especially when it's the right move.
You know, we're talking about who to root for, or I guess who deserves it. It's a strange thing that I find myself, you know, I've never been a Derek Jeter fan, I've never been a detractor of his, but, Derek Jeter's just the star of the evil empire, so I don't necessarily associate him as the personification of all things bad. He sort of is the baseball equivalent of Tom Brady. The Patriots and Belichick I find terribly unlikable, but Tom Brady, it's hard to really riddle with bullets. You know, I think he seems like a decent fella, seems like a good guy and everything. Same thing with Jeter, and it's bizarre to feel like, man, Jeter hasn't had the greatest World Series. He's had a good World Series, but I kind of am hoping that at this stage of his career, fairly late in the game for him, that it would be cool to see Derek Jeter lead the charge in Game 6 or Game 7 and be the difference maker in the Yankees getting back on top. You know what I mean?
Well, it's fair. I think they just have so many contributors. Look what Johnny Damon has done in the last couple of games.
Well, Kubiak, he can't be rooted for. He's all that's wrong with sports, Kerry.
Well,
you know
right.
That I hate that. He went from the Red Sox to the Yankees, and then when questioned about it, he said, yeah, that sort of rivalry stuff is more for the fans. We players don't care about that. No, shame the devil. That's the worst thing you can say as a player.
Yeah, no, that's true. My argument was just basically they have a lot of contributors. Matt Dewey's barely played, and he's been ever as good as Utley has when he's been in the lineup. He's been fantastic. Burnett had one very good start. Rivera, obviously, is Rivera. Even Domingo Marte is contributing. They have a lot of contributors. So, you know, certainly from a storyline standpoint, it would be great if Jeter did that. But, I mean, if the guy's going to hit, 300 with moderate power and filled his position, okay, that's fine. It was funny. When he came up in the ninth inning, I was on Twitter with this, and I'm throwing off wisecracks on a live blog on WSJ, and I'm on Twitter and stuff. And when Jeter came up, it's first and third, nobody out in the ninth inning, and it came to me like a flash. If Derek Jeter were to hit into a triple play at that point to end the game, that would be the single most satisfying event in the history of organized sport. There is no question in my mind. Nothing. Derek Jeter hits into a triple play to end a World Series game. That would have been unstoppable. You know what? Even Derek Jeter might have had a good sense of humor about that, because how can you possibly beat that? So that's what I was kind of looking for. He did hit into a double play, and so people were giving me partial credit for it. But the triple play would have been something.
Yeah, I did notice you did that. And at Jonah Carey on Twitter is always a treat to when you're watching the big game. So make sure you sign up for him on that one. And that is the beauty of playoff baseball. And, you know, I've sort of disparaged the sport. You know, obviously the lousy umpiring has gotten the headlines. I almost feel like, unless there is a special Game 6, actually, if the Yankees end up celebrating in new Yankee Stadium or the Phillies pull off the comeback, that's going to trump the bad umping that went on through the postseason here. But I feel like that right now, that's sort of the story of the postseason, which is a shame. But when I watch postseason baseball, it really is, there's an intensity to it that is unique, because I feel like when there's a pitcher out there in the eighth inning, when I was watching Jabba Chamberlain in the eighth inning of game four, I was thinking, wow, this really is going to define his career on some level, what he does here. And he ends up giving up the home run and they end up winning the game. So that was inaccurate. But you see him throwing that tailing fastball, 96 miles an hour and everything. And you thought, like, this is going to make his career now. If he closes this one out and hands it over to Rivera, now he goes into next season positioned as a starter, and he ascends even higher there. I love the intensity and how a career is defined by one at bat or one half inning for a pitcher out there on the hump.
Well, in a way, it's the most compelling with guys who are either real old or real young. In Jabba's case, this is the beginning for him. You know,
right, exactly, right.
So, I mean, you know, this could be, oh, he's the guy who did this, and then he can kind of coast on that for a few years. Or if it's an older guy, even if it's a guy who's not hugely successful, but he's on his last legs and he gets that big strikeout, nobody's going to remember the time in Kansas City in 2002 that he blew that game. They're going to remember 2009 that he went out in a blaze of glory and struck out Ryan Howard with the game on the line. I mean, that's the stuff. So, yeah, that's absolutely the case. You know, I can make a contrarian argument with Jabba, because I'm the man for contrarian arguments, and say maybe it's good that he blew that home run, that he gave it up to Feliz. Because if you look at it, there's a huge debate going on in New York since the first day that Jabba Chamberlain stepped on a field about whether he should be a starting pitcher or whether he should be a relief pitcher. And I maintain, till the day I die, that Jabba Chamberlain absolutely has to be a starting pitcher. I don't think there's any question about it. When you're talking about a starting pitcher, a guy who can throw 200 really good innings, how many guys like that are there who do it every single year? 10? 15, 20, I don't know. How many guys are turned into closers? Eric Gagne was a disaster of a starting pitcher. They converted him to a closer. He was great. Billy Wagner, failed starting pitcher. Mariano Rivera, failed starting pitcher. Ugueth Urbina, name any guy, you know, almost any closer. Jose Mesa, when he was good, he's a failed starting pitcher. Every single one of these guys were not good enough to throw 200 innings. They realized, okay, if you just let them throw as hard as they can for one inning, they can be fine. Jabba Chamberlain has the skills to be a starting pitcher. You can go find relief pitchers almost on trees, put him in the starting rotation, not in the bullpen. It's wonderful what he's doing this postseason for the Yankees. Mazel tov to them. Opening day next year, he has to be in the starting rotation.
Now, speaking of starting pitchers, Game 6, what do you think of Girardi's decision to run Andy Pettitte out there on 3 days rest?
I just don't know what the other option is. I mean, they're going to go Chad Gaudin. I mean, it's just they sort of are where they are, and this has to do with Jabba Chamberlain. Again, I mean, if they had really stuck with him throughout the season, not kind of jerked him around, think of what Rick Porcello, how he was treated with the Detroit Tigers. This is a guy who's 20 years old. 20. So, I mean, he's a very young guy. There's always concern about running up a lot of innings on starting pitchers. He was a very good, an above-average starting pitcher throughout the season. I wouldn't say that they babied him, but they were careful, and if the team was up 6-0 in the fifth or sixth inning, they'd pull him, and they wouldn't worry about it. And they managed his innings. He threw about, 175, 180 innings, and he was very good all season long. There's no reason they couldn't have done that with Jabba. The so-called Jabba rules, they didn't do it right. They went, you know, they tried to be cautious, and they said, make him a reliever instead. Be consistent. You know, you got to stick with a plan, and they didn't do that. If Jabba was in the starting rotation and was effective, then he could easily be the guy, and they wouldn't need, you know, 3 day rest. They could go with a 4-man rotation, or they could go 3-man on CC and go 4-man on everybody else. I mean, you know, so there were a lot of options they could have had. They could have made David Robertson, could have taken Jabba's job. We saw how well he pitched last night. He's a good relief pitcher. They've got some guys in that pen other than Rivera. They didn't need to put themselves in this situation, but because of how they treated Jabba, the direct result is Chad Gaudin or old guy on short rest. This is what you get when you're the Yankees.
Well, what do you think about specifically what Chase Utley's been doing? Obviously has been lethal, one-man wrecking crew and whatever other cliche you want to throw out there. At this point now, if you're Girardi with what Ryan Howard hasn't been doing this series, any consideration to just giving Utley at least pitching around him and seeing if Ryan Howard's going to hurt you?
Certainly with a left-handed pitcher on the mound. With Pettitte on the mound, I would definitely do that because Utley doesn't really have a weakness left-right. If you look over the course of his career, not just this season, not a big splits guy. Howard always has been. He's had a couple of hits versus left-handers this postseason, but for the most part, he's much, much, much better against righties. I mean, the difference in his career, righties versus lefties, it's something like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of an example. Something like Albert Pujols to Mike Lowell. Like, it's just a gigantic gap. Gigantic. You know, he's really one of the best hitters in the whole game, probably top two or three against right-handers, but he's just some guy against lefties. So, yeah, you know, if you get in that situation and Pettitte is on the mound, certainly if you've got first base open, I think that's a gimme. But even in different kinds of situations, what about first and third, you know, with two outs, and it's the game's on the line? Do you load the bases and put Howard up there? Maybe. It's possible. You know, I would definitely consider these kinds of options because, you know, right now, it's not just that Utley's on a hot streak, it's that we should expect this because Utley has always been the best player in the Phillies. Howard has an MVP and Rollins has an MVP, but Utley was always better than those guys because he was consistent, he had the offense and the defense, and he played a premium position. He's their guy, and he's really showing it this postseason. So, yeah, I would be very careful with him.
Just for the sake of an objective baseball fan, I'm rooting for a Game 7, obviously, in Yankee Stadium. That would be swell, defending champs, evil empire, so on and so forth. How do you think Pedro fares out there, though, for the Phillies? What do you expect out of him and his ability to get it to a Game 7?
Well, I'll do a quick self-plug. If you go to jonahkerry.com, J-O-N-A-H-K-E-R-I.com, scroll down a bit, I wrote a story called The Pedro I Know, and it's about Pedro Martinez and his early days with the Expos, and it's very nostalgic, and of course I'm going to talk about the Expos, but it gets into the whole, you know, it's really just Pedro and his whole career, and it talks about the kind of guy that he is. He used to be known as this big headhunter back in the day, and, you know, that people would charge him out and go after him, who's this skinny kid to throw in me, and then he became great, he became the best pitcher in baseball, one of the best of all time. And even when he was at the height of his powers, you know, at the beginning, in the middle, and toward the end here, he's always been that guy that has a chip on his shoulder. You know, the whole thing about he says, oh, if Babe Ruth was up at the plate, I'd knock him on his ass. Well, he felt that way when he was 21, that he would try to knock people on their ass. And now that he's almost 40, he still feels that way. He might not do it with a fastball that's 97 miles an hour, but he'll find a way to just get a psychological edge against you, even with kind of mediocre stuff. That's Pedro. And you know, you look at game two, it's amazing. He pitched quite well in that game, and he gave his team a chance to win. Who would have thought that a few months ago? This wasn't just a guy who wasn't pitching well. He wasn't pitching. He was in the Dominican Republic throwing 83-mile-an-hour fastballs. The Tampa Bay Rays, as resourceful and shrewd as any team in baseball, they'll do anything to win. They go down to Dominican Republic. A couple other teams went down, too, but the Rays go down. They'll leave no stone unturned. They go down, and they report back, this guy can't pitch in Major League Baseball. Pedro's finished. There's no chance. Phillies pick him up. You're looking at a team that's a pennant contender. You're saying, what, the Philadelphia Phillies really need Pedro Martinez? That doesn't make any sense. And here he is in Game 2 and then Game 6 of the World Series. This guy, it's strength of will. It's strength of will and a changeup. Honestly, that's what it is. That's what he's going with right now. He's throwing 88 miles an hour, gunning it right down the middle by people because they're so scared of that changeup. That's still a great pitch. He just, you know, he has the ability to control a game even with lesser stuff. It's remarkable. I mean, I guess if you're a Yankees fan, you're not going to root for Pedro, but almost any other fan of baseball has to root for this guy. What a great career it's been, and the fact that he's now doing it on fumes, that's almost more impressive. I think it's tremendous. It's a great story. I spent about 2,000 words writing about the guy, so if you want to check that out, check it out. I mean, I'm an unabashed Pedro fan, and he deserves every bit of credit that he's gotten.
Well, I'll look forward to reading that myself. I actually sat in Dodger Stadium a couple of weeks ago when he dominated for 7 innings in Dodger Stadium. It was Dynamite that day, and Chaz Manuel probably pulled him a little bit too early there. So, listen, we're again, speaking of a little too early, there's a lot, everybody's speculating about who the MVP of this series is already. And, you know, listen, if Chase Utley hits one more, win or lose, I think you got to give it to Chase Utley. How say you?
Yeah, you know, people were talking about that online. People were having discussions about it. And I think you could make that case for Utley even if they lose. It's very rare that it happens in sports. It only happened in one or two Super Bowls and one or two World Series.
Go ahead and name the losing MVP from a Super Bowl.
Harvey Martin for the Cowboys was
no,
one of
the things. No, you got the right team. But Harvey Martin and
Randy. Was it Jones or
No, you're getting colder now. No, it was Harvey Martin, and he shared it. That was another unique aspect of the Cowboys. Randy White and Harvey Martin shared it in Super Bowl XII, but no, it was another Cowboy, the only losing player to be the Super Bowl MVP. One more guest?
Dorsett? I don't know.
No, it was Chuck Howley, number 54, when they wore the blue jerseys. The only time the Cowboys have ever worn the blue jerseys in a Super Bowl, when Jim O'Brien made the field goal to win it for the Colts. Super Bowl V.
Yeah, I mean, it is rare. I mean, Major League Baseball, at least I came up with Harvey Martin, even though it wasn't a losing team. I can't think of, I mean, it very rarely happens in baseball. I know it's happened once or twice, but I honestly can't think of who the name is. Utley's just been so good. And the thing is, it's very evenly distributed, this World Series. We talked about all those Yankees heroes. I really think that Johnny Damon has made a case. I mean, the stolen base is one thing, but he knocked in the winning runs the game before, too. You know, and he got on 2-3 times yesterday, too. He's been very, very solid, and he's kind of a much maligned guy. He's making $13 million a year. His noodle arm, you know, it's noodly. I mean, he cannot throw anybody out. There's no question. But look, you know, we have a tendency in sports, we focus on a guy's weaknesses. We say, well, yeah, but, you know, this guy, well, he's great, but he can't make the outside shot. Well, he's great, but, you know, he doesn't do the sideline route very well. Well, he can't do this. So what? Damon's been good at what he needs to be doing. You know, he's getting on base. He's doing good things. I think he could be one. I guess if Rivera notches another save, you know, that could be a possibility. There's a bunch of guys. It's because that it's so split between different players that you can make that case. I will say this, though. If it goes 7 games and Utley just has a kind of a pedestrian game 6 and game 7, and then Sabathia wins game 7, you got to go Sabathia. Just by virtue of pitching 3 times in the World Series, let alone pitching well all 3 times, he'd have to be my guy at that point.
All right. Well, listen, I'm looking forward to it, and I know you are too. And also, it's great to know that now I know what to get Jonah Carey for Hanukkah, a picture of his head on a centaur. Apparently,
nice.
That pleases you. Real quick, though, we are now into November. We were talking about it with DJ Gallo yesterday. I now ask you the question with Thanksgiving fast approaching here. First of all, best Thanksgiving side dish.
Best Thanksgiving side dish. See, I don't like cranberry at all. I am.
Wow. See, so far that's unanimous.
Yeah, I'm an anti-cranberry guy. I mean, you know, I've had stuffings that are just phenomenal. I'm a huge mushroom guy. So if you can load up the stuffing with mushrooms, make that the big part of the base, and that's the kind that I usually get when I'm around, that's what I'll go with. So you're talking a real heavily mushroomed stuffing. That would be my favorite.
I like where your head's at on that. And then once the feast is completed, dessert comes. What's the best Thanksgiving pie?
So here's the thing. I'm not a big pie guy, and I'll tell you why. In my opinion, pie is just a scam against the cake industry. I feel like pie, oh yeah, let's take all this crust and it's full of lard and it has all this stuff. Cake's better. I mean, chocolate cake, a good piece of chocolate cake is just better than a crusty piece of pie, generally speaking. But wow, this is my opinion. But the wife has found a way to get around this problem by making crustless apple pie.
Ooh.
It is phenomenal. There's a little bit of, you know, kind of, whatever you want to say, a little bit of dough underneath, but there's no, like, side crust or anything like that. So you're basically getting the apples, you're getting the cinnamon, you're getting the sugar, you're getting just enough of that little bit, and that's it. You don't have to deal with the heavy, oh, it's so crunchy, and oh, it's gone bad, and da-da-da. Moist, delicious, crustless apple pie. That is my favorite.
I'm sorry. It was eloquent, but it was inaccurate. Listen,
pie, my friend.
First of all, I'll tell you who really would go crazy on you is Adam Carolla, because he goes on and on about how terrible cake is and how pie is much better. In fact, he goes so far as he doesn't celebrate his birthday with a birthday cake. He has birthday pie.
I like that he's sticking to his convictions. That's a very unorthodox thing to do. So I do respect that, even though I think that pie is for the birds.
Well, listen, pumpkin pie, to answer my own question, pumpkin cheesecake is a delicious seasonal treat.
Cheesecake is good. You could make, you know, gravel cheesecake and it would taste good.
I'll try that. Yeah, we'll see. And but you know what? Hot, you know, warmed up pecan pie. That's hard to argue with. That's a delicious treat.
Have you spent significant time in the South? Because it seems like that's a very Southern choice.
Yeah. Well, no, I haven't to answer, but I still love. You know what I did do? Where I really fell in love with it. I used to work many moons ago in a Cajun restaurant, shucking oysters and stuff.
You see, that's good stuff.
And they always had the pecan pie.
That's
and right
nice.
Around now is pumpkin cheesecake time. Oh, no wonder I gained about about 117 pounds when I was working there for a year.
So you got to be like me on the podcast. When we talk, and we'll talk for about an hour, I'm actually walking around the house the whole time. I must burn about 500 calories between my ranting about how much Jose Molina sucks and my walking around the house. I'm in tip-top shape. I've got six-pack abs just from being on the Damashek show.
Well, you know, it's funny. I have to finish. I'm pleased to hear that. I have to finish the pie versus cake argument with this. I've shared this thought many times before. But, you know, the old cliche, he wants to have his cake and eat it too. I understand what it's getting at, but the way it comes off to me is that it sounds as though you're being gluttonous by eating the cake. You know, it's like, well, Damashek, I gave him a cake, but that wasn't good enough for him to just have the cake. He went and ate it. Can you imagine that monster doing that? What a pig. I think they should change it. He wants to have his cake and some pie. Now that's gluttony, you see?
Yeah, I agree, and I didn't really understand that expression. It doesn't really make sense to me just on a verbal level. I'm very confused by it, so I'm fine with that. You got to change it. I agree.
I researched that heavily, and in fact, and was able to figure it out finally, that what it means is you want to eat your cake. In fact, correctly stated, people, I guess, typically it's a malaprop for 98% of us. We say he wants to have his cake and eat it too. Instead, it should be he wants to eat his cake and have it too, meaning you want to consume it and then still have it for later.
Oh, well, but then how did that get back?
I don't know. It ruins the whole thing. And the other cliche that I'm sure we'll hear if there's a game seven is there's no love lost between these two teams. What does that mean? That's sort of like a sarcastic remark, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, well, cliches can't have sarcasm in them. It's confusing to people.
We're both writers, and I'm confused by this stuff. If I was just making up expressions, there's no way I'd start with things that just don't make sense on a basic level in the English language, or that are just tweaking someone by being sarcastic. I don't know. All these things that the English language has, it's very confusing. Sometimes I just get frustrated. I just start speaking Hebrew to myself and just kind of nod along, and that's about it.
I don't have that option of a second language, unfortunately. But, the other, you know, another cliche now that we're talking about it is that makes me crazy is killing two birds with one stone. I want to see somebody kill a single bird with a stone. That's some shot. That, take a bird out with your arm? That's
what if it's an ostrich?
Well, I guess we saw we saw Larry David take out the black swan in the most recent Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, see, swans are there. That's a gimme. You know, if you're talking about a roadrunner or something like that, you're not hucking it with a stone. There's no way.
Yeah, well, Randy Johnson took out a bird with a baseball. It wasn't a stone.
See, Winfield did that too, right?
Right. Yeah.
Winfield at Exhibition Stadium.
That's exact. Was it? Oh, I always thought that was Seattle.
It was Exhibition Stadium. There's no stadium in sports history that's ever had more birds and more uncomfortable seats than the old crappy Exhibition Stadium.
I'm sad I never got to attend a game there, or the old Forum, or anything else. And, Joe, you know what? One more question before I let you go, because now that reminds me of the beloved sport of puck. And you, in fact, emailed me about Kid Crosby dropping the gloves. Listen, he's no stranger to it now. It's no accident. He's no fancy pants who has Dave Semenko defending him at all times. Listen, you get in his kitchen, he'll drop the gloves and give you what for. But also, those Habs uniforms over the weekend, the blue blanc et rouge, those were crazy looking uniforms. But it is the 50th anniversary now of Jacques Plante pulling on the first goalie mask, your favorite goalie mask of all time.
I like Cujo. You know, it's fierce. It's just, you know, it's the way that it's shaped and stuff like that. And obviously, no love lost for the Maple Leafs. But, yeah, you know, Cujo's mask was pretty darn solid. And the other one that I really liked, and this is a little bit old school, and it was very plain, Mike Liut.
Oh, I was about to buzz you on that. I was about to buzz you for your first answer. But Mike Liut with the simple but somehow sinister-looking. It almost had eyebrows.
He's going to murder you.
Yeah, it somehow had eyebrows, like angry-looking.
Yeah. I mean, Cujo just, you know, because there's something to be said for, you know, there's some artist out there whose job it is, you know, I don't know how much these things cost to make, but they're airbrushing it. They're probably working on it forever. You know, maybe that is a little bit too shishy because it seems like you're trying too hard. But, I mean, Cujo I just thought was cool. But Mike Liut, I mean, that's just, he used to haunt my dreams at night. You know, he was in the NHL when I was probably about, I don't know, 8, 9, 10. These are formative years for nightmares. Mike Liut used to give me problems, I have to say.
Yeah, that was a swell one, too. And former Leaf and also Capital, Mike Palmateer had the great American flag one. I always dug that one when I was a kid. So
that's a good one, too. You know, I'm not much of a jingo guy, but I appreciate that.
All right, well, listen. So, Jonah Carey, once again, we've gone from the Fall Classic to Puck and a little bit of pie talk in between. Always a pleasure to yap with you. Like I say, ubiquitous at Jonah Carey on Twitter. Always fun to follow him there. JonahCarey.com, JonahKerry.com. There, WSJ.com, always contributing. I believe you can still track down his bullfighting column in the most recent issue of Penthouse, if I'm not mistaken, Jonah.
Correct,
yes?
Correct. The November edition.
Okay, and like I say, he's all over the place, and track him down online. Twitter's a good place to go. Jonah, we'll look forward to yapping with you soon.
Thank you, Dave.
And again, mazel tov on the Bris, and mazel tov on hopefully a good games 6 and 7 in the World Series.
Let's keep our fingers crossed.
Be well.
You're listening to Dave Damaschek. You're listening to Dave Damaschek. You're listening to Dave Damaschek.
There he goes, the great Jonah Carey, everybody, and I guess we may as well get out of here ourselves. Tomorrow, though, we'll be talking college football with our pal from AccuScore.com, the Blue Horseshoe himself, Zach Rosenfield. Enjoy the World Series, and in the meantime, thanks so much, podcasters. It's been a thin slice of heaven.
Damashek, Damashek, loves Lemieux, hates Belichick. Spins a yarn, any size, blasts those jerks just like flies. Look out, here comes Dave Damashek. Is he fast? Not a bit, but he makes up for it with tons of grit. If he's wrong, what's he do? Says he's wrong like quarterback taught him to. Hey there goes Dave Damashek. Cool Cat spelled with K's is his fantasy team. When they hit the field, Bill Simmons starts to cry. Damashek, Damashek, his best friend is his TV set. Steelers fan since days of old, instead of red bleeds black and gold. Look out, it's Dave Damashek.